The Fan on Demand. Melky leads T.O. past Texas.
Here's his 1-0 pitch. Line drive up the middle. Through the glove of Odor. Goes into center field. A base hit. Goes, scores. Here comes Reyes. The throw. He scores standing up. A two-run shot up the middle by Melky. And the Blue Jays lead it 9-5.
You're listening to Brady and Walker on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
7:02. Good morning, Brady and Walker. On your Monday, it's a big week for Blue Jays baseball. The Red Sox in town tonight. Four game set. You got Hutchinson and John Lackey in the opener. Coverage begins at 7 right here. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Jays take 2-3 from the Texas Rangers, including 9-6 yesterday. I'm Andrew Walker. He is Eric Smith. This was a series that, well, I'll go back to Friday night. So they're heading in. It's you, Darvish, on Friday. Always knew that was going to be a tough one to win. But what were your thoughts heading into this series as a whole? The worst team, believe it or not, the worst team in the American League, the Texas Rangers, coming in. This is clearly a series they had to have. Had to have.
Yeah, you had to take at least two. So you got your two. I mean, at some point there needs to be a run, a really good run, and it might not match what you did earlier this season, but there needs to be a good chunk of games rhymed off, and I think taking two of three is a good start right there. But, you know, I know it sounds completely cliche and obvious, but these are these winnable games that you have to take care of, especially yeah. on your home field. You've got to be able to do this, and I say the exact same thing with Boston coming to town now for four. You've got to take three of four against the Red Sox. It's at some point you're going to start making up ground on the division, the leaders, excuse me, in Baltimore. You've got to start. You can't just keep splitting series. You've got to go out there and start winning series again consistently.
See, and I guess we're arguing semantics now, but this is where I differ a little bit, is that you look at this Blue Jays lineup, and even though the bats got going a little bit this weekend, it was good to see. It's still not where they need to be. They're mm-hmm. still without Encarnacion for a couple of weeks. They're still without Brett Laurie for a couple of weeks. And they're still without Adam Lind for a couple of weeks. The Red Sox are playing pretty well, and they're healthy. If they come in here and you split this week with the Boston Red Sox, I don't think it's the end of the world. The next 2 weeks, to me, it still isn't the time to go on this run. For me, it's still an element of keeping your head above water and having your full lineup ready to go for the last 50 games of the season.
See, and I hear you, but I'll play the what if. What if, though, when the bodies come back, they're not playing at the top of their game for a week or two? That buries your theory, I guess, in a sense, of waiting for them to come back for another week or two.
I'll take a 70% Edwin Encarnacion over a 100%
Yeah, but
Dan
do you want
Johnson.
Edwin Encarnacion from April and into May, or do you want him from, you know, mid to late May and into June? Because there's clearly a difference in the player that hit one home run or whatever in the first month of the season that got out of the gate extremely slow.
I'll gladly take somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Right?
And Brett Laurie, you know, his...
Do you want
his,
the guy that started the season, or do you want the guy that was lighting it up in May along with everybody else?
Yeah. Laurie's stick has been okay. Defensively, obviously a major upgrade over anybody that they would have at third or at second at this point. But offensively, is he going to be a guy that ignites your offense or gives you a lot? Adam Lind, you know, are you going to continue to platoon him versus righties versus lefties? I mean, there's been a lot of the decisions that have been made this year, I'm going to say even more so by, not necessarily by Anthopoulos, but when you look at what's happening with some of the decision-making in terms of position guys and platooning center field, platooning first base and whatnot. I think John Gibbons, he's been dealt a tough hand because of the injury bug, but I think some of the decisions made as well. At some point, you just got to go with your big guns, I think, and say, listen, healthy or unhealthy, if Adam Lind can be on the field, I'm obviously talking before the injury, if he can play, I don't care if it's a righty or lefty, he's playing. You know, when he had his Silver Slugger season, he was hitting 270 plus against left-handed batters. He's going to play. Colby Rasmus, if he's my best center fielder, he's playing, whether it's against a righty or lefty. I'm not going to sub him in and out and platoon him with Mastriani or anybody else. You've got to start at some point saying, these are our best players, no matter what the stats say at the time, these are our best players, and we're going with them. And that, to me, talks a little bit, Andrew, maybe, to what you're saying of go with your guns and let's see if you can just kind of keep that head above water.
7:06, we'll get you your Monday morning six pack in just a few minutes. It's interesting you mention Rasmus because the biggest impression all weekend for me, and I know there was three right-handed pitchers in the mound. Against lefties, it might be a different story. But Colby Rasmus, before that All-Star break, looked like he was in a really bad spot.
Mm-hmm.
And over this weekend, with, I believe it was five hits on the weekend, including a home run off Yu Darvish, Colby Rasmus looked like good Colby Rasmus. And if the Blue Jays are going to go on this run...
he needs to be that guy.
Yeah, because right now, without missing those three... and Jose Bautista's just been okay. If anything, he's actually struggled over the last little bit.
I don't think he's healthy right now either.
The Jays need some guys to carry this team. They need Reyes to play better. Mm-hmm. He had a good weekend. Melky had a really good weekend. And so did Colby Rasmus. Right? Colby Rasmus goes 0-for-12 with 10 Ks in a series. It really hurts your chances. It really does. I thought he stood out to me. And another guy that stood out, and I'm going to...
I know what you're going to say.
I'm going to ask a weird question, and I'm not saying I believe it. I'm just saying it's amazing that we're asking this question. Out of all the things that Alex Anthopoulos probably needs to do, or fans want him to do, Eric, and that includes bullpen help, and includes a starting pitcher, maybe, includes a third baseman if Brett Lurie is going to play second. It includes a right-handed batter off the bench, whatever. With the way that Munenori Kawasaki is playing at second base, is adding a second baseman the most important thing in the world for him? Look at these numbers. Kawasaki, who now has 110 at-bats, right? This is not a tiny sample size, is hitting .294, and over his last 10 games is hitting .375 with six multi-hit games in there, including another five-hit weekend against the Texas Rangers. Is it at all possible that Kawasaki is maybe better than we think?
I think so. I think he's proving it. I think the numbers don't lie. As you said, the sample size, we're not talking about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's not a big sample size.
It's big enough, though.
But it's not a minuscule. But it's not a minuscule sample size.
I think we thought last year when he came up that he was sort of the cheerleader. He was the guy that kind of kept the locker room light.
You can say the M word. It's okay.
He was the mascot.
Sure.
And he played okay defensively, offensively, abysmal at the best of times. But suddenly now he's playing pretty well defensively, and he's actually swinging the bat.
The guy's been hitting.
And he's fundamentally very sound as well with...
Thank you very much!
You're welcome. With the way that he runs, the way that he just thinks the game out there, both offensively and defensively, I think it probably gives Alex Anthopoulos a little bit of breathing room to know that he has something to work with there if he doesn't have to fill their hole. That said, let's be honest. He still would be a good piece to bring off the bench.
Yeah.
If you can improve, especially with a bigger bat.
Not saying he's an everyday player. And it sounds crazy to say, but right now it's impossible to not recognize how good this guy's been hitting over the last 3 weeks. 10 after 7, I'm Andrew Walker. He's Eric Smith. Let's get you what you need to know on your Monday.
This is your Monday morning six pack. Six things you need to start your day.
All right, number six. Yes, my regular co-host, Greg Brady, is on holidays. So, Monday to Friday this week, Eric Smith, you know him from the Raptors broadcast here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and of course, Sportsnet Television as well, is my co-host. 15 years here at The Fan. Raptors broadcaster, but you did fill in for Jamie Campbell this year on Blue Jay Central. Now, it was on that long road trip.
Yes,
I think your record was 1-6 or
indeed
something like that. Yeah. But how was that, your first foray?
It was really good.
To a baseball television.
No, I enjoyed it. You know, Blue Jays Express last summer, had a good time hosting that show, and then getting a chance to sort of dip my toe back in the Blue Jay water this year. It was nice, even though they did go 1-6. So that made for some late nights. You know, talk about early morning right now. Late nights on a West Coast when the Jays are just getting
absolutely pounded. I was up for the whole broadcast. I had to get up and do this show.
Well, that's your problem.
Blue Jays.
Why would you stay up? Were you actually awake for those West Coast?
Yeah.
Games? So what, you're coming in on like 2 hours sleep?
Yeah, basically.
That's pretty much what I'm doing today.
One job and it's to watch sports. It's not that bad. Blue Jays Express, underrated show. I miss it already.
As he says with a laugh.
I miss it already. I can't believe it only lasted one season.
I'll bring you a t-shirt.
I've seen worse sitcoms go longer. I will say that.
Like
the Big Bang Theory.
I've never seen that show.
Number five. It was a 2-0. They were calling it yesterday. The Honda Indy was on the streets of Toronto. A lot of rain on Saturday, so they had to race two yesterday. Sebastian Bourdais and Mike Conway were your winners. A rough weekend for James Hinchcliffe. We will talk to Eric Thomas from Raceline Radio about it next. Get his take on what went wrong with Hinchcliffe at 7:23. Number four, give you an update from the American League East. The Baltimore Orioles lose 10-2 to Oakland. So they've lost two of three. The Blue Jays pick up some ground, Eric, and they get back to within three. And this kind of flies in the face of what I was saying earlier. For the Blue Jays, right now, I think the next couple weeks, 500 is still that level. You can go a couple games above. You can keep your head above water. At the same time, though, this Orioles club has a really difficult schedule.
13 games coming up against the Angels and Mariners, period. They're at the Angels, at the Mariners, then back home to host the Angels, host the Mariners.
Number three, Rory McIlroy leads the British Open wire to wire for his third major championship at the age of 25. Only Jack and Tiger had done that before him. Tiger makes the cut, but was never a factor after day one. He finished his sixth over and 69th. For Rory, he only won by two, but it was really never in doubt. Started the day with a six-stroke lead, and he really cruised to victory. Do you like the dominance of a guy like Rory, or have you really missed the drama this year? Because we're kind of 0-for-3 on major photo finishes, so to speak.
I want to see a little bit more drama. The only guy that I enjoyed watching dominate was Tiger Woods. And I know you and I differ on Tiger, but he was the one guy I enjoyed just watching pound the competition. I didn't take that same enjoyment with Rory. I want to see a little drama. I want to see a little tighter finish.
Number two, it is D-Day for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And Cody Franzen, bit of a controversial figure on the blue line. And today is his arbitration hearing. Later today, the Leafs have reportedly tabled the value of $2 million. Franzen comes in wanting 4.2. So those two sides are about $2 million apart. They could still split the difference on a deal somewhere right in the middle. And they can do that seconds before arbitration if they want.
James, isn't that Reimer, the easiest solution?
You would think so. But I still think, we'll get into this a little later on, but I still think the goal is to find a deal the Maple Leafs can trade him with. I really still don't think that Cody Franzen is going to be on this blue line next season. James Reimer goes to arbitration next Monday. The number one thing you need to know, the Blue Jays win it 9-6 against Texas. They had to have it, and they got it. Melky Cabrera drives in three with a three-hit day, three games back of the Baltimore Orioles in the American League. You see it, the Jays and the Red Sox tonight. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Lackey and Hutchison. Coverage begins at 7. The Blue Jays ticket window opens up every morning at 7:14 here on Brady and Walker, courtesy of the Great Blue Heron Casino. We will send you to a Blue Jays game later this week. Our question this morning, who is the last Red Sox player to have his number retired by Boston? Give us a call right now, 416-870-0590. Star 590 on your cell phone if you'd like to go to the Jays and the Red Sox on Thursday afternoon. It's a 12:30 start at the Rogers Center.
I'm going to be down
there. That answer next.
You're listening to Brady and Walker on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
7:23, good morning. Brady and Walker on your Monday. Four-game series with the Boston Red Sox getting underway tonight. Thursday's a matinee. It's a 12:30 start in the afternoon, the fourth game of four in that series. Congratulations to Ricky and Markham.
Oh, good for you.
He is going to see that game courtesy of the Great Blue Heron Casino. Blue Jays ticket window opening up every morning at 7:14. He knew the answer to our question this morning. Who is the last Red Sox player to have his number retired by Boston? That was Jim Rice. His number 14 was retired back in 2009. Listen, tomorrow at 7:14, you will have a chance to win Blue Jays tickets for the next home series. Coming up at 7:29 this morning. Now, last week I told you about a guy who's still a free agent that I thought the Leafs should give a look to. I can tell you today, that free agent is not going to be coming here to Toronto. I'll tell you who that is in about 5 minutes. But first, we go to Eric Thomas, the host of Raceline Radio here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan is the Honda Indy, the rain-delayed Honda Indy, was in Toronto over the weekend, and they raced a pair yesterday. Good morning, Eric. How are you?
Good morning, boys. Yeah, we're good. A little soggy, but it all turned out well in the end, because with two 65-lap sprint races almost, it was some pretty darn good entertainment. And I think the fans that were there got their money's worth, and it was, well, it may not have been worth going through all the hassle we had to on Saturday and get everything rained ahead, but I just, in the end, it worked out okay.
Yeah, it was a long delay on Saturday, and if you saw the highlights, you saw the pace car wipeout.
Yeah,
and
a couple of guys way too dangerous to try. I know that IndyCar is getting lambasted by some of the media and some fans for saying, well, you're supposed to run in the rain. Why don't you just start it behind the pace car? Well, when the pace car can't stay on the racetrack because there's so much rain and there's no traction, what the devil do you think 800 horsepower IndyCars are going to do? You saw what happened as soon as Will Power tried to apply the power. You know, he wiped it out into the wall. And is that what you want to do? Stack them all up in one? Well, there's your show. Come on, you know, think about it. I mean, when it's a safety issue, and the drivers are telling you that it's not safe, you can't see, there's no traction, don't run the race. They did the right thing.
Yeah, it was really slick, and even for somebody that does know a lot about racing, you could see it was pretty dangerous. So for the first time,
your passenger car, what the heck, let alone a race car.
So for the first time since 1981, they rode two races in the same day. How does that change the strategy and the outlook and maybe the aggressiveness of some of these drivers?
I think what the way you handle that is exactly the way Bourdais used to win the first race. You have to have a pit stop, obviously, but you put on the red option tires, the fast tires, the ones that let you go fast, but they also wear out quicker, and you just go for it. Put your foot down and go for it. I mean, this guy just was on the whip from lap one through lap 65. He had leads that we have not seen as big on that course in quite a long time, 3 to 4 seconds, like he's in the other area code, right? But, I mean, you don't have time, as the NASCAR guys say, you don't have time to lollygag. You just get on it and get it done. And that's, you try to do that in race two, some wrecks got in the way. Conway more or less did the same thing, came up in the right sequence, you know, did a nice tire change there and was able to pull that off. But there was a little rain around that one as well. But what you do is the green flag goes up and just get after it. And you saw guys getting after it. It was pretty good entertainment because of that, though. You saw guys taking chances. You saw, you know, people going around there, you know, side by side almost, you know, almost the entire lap. No time. You just attack it. You can't lay back. It's like a sprint race. Get after it, and that's what Bourdais did, and good to see him finally win one first since 2007. You know, he thinks the fans don't like him here because of his entanglements with Paul Tracy years ago, but it all worked out good in terms of, well, you haven't got time to lay back, so put on a show, and that's exactly what they did in both races, and Bourdais certainly in the first one.
E.T., you talk about putting on a show. It hasn't been, a homecoming in a sense for James Hinchcliffe ever, essentially. I mean, and struggles again this weekend.
Yeah, unfortunately, and that's true, and he's frustrated with it, and we interviewed him on the air, and he had the fans cheering him. They're behind him 100%. He knows that grandstand, but most of it is behind him. But, you know, this is something that you go through. He had three wins coming into this race last year. He's still looking for his first race this year, his first win. You know, the team is so good, though, and he is so up, and they never get down. Drivers will go through this dry spell. They're qualifying well. Their pit work is fantastic. He got, you know, into the back of somebody there in the second race and finished 18th. Top 10 in the first one, not bad at all. But he'll get out of this, and I predict that he'll have a win before the end of the year. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be happening in Toronto. He would dearly love it to happen that way, and so would the fans, but it'll eventually lock in.
We had Hinchcliffe on the air last week, and one of the questions I asked him was, you know, he went out, he missed some time with that concussion, and I don't want to say rushed back, but he was better. He was good to go sooner than he thought he would be. Do you think that's lingered, that's caused anything? He said no, but of course that's what he's going to say.
He's going to say no, and I tend to believe him because he's a smart enough guy to know, and the team, you know, with Andretti have been, you know, this isn't their first rodeo. I mean, these guys know that these kinds of things happen. I think the last guy that would jeopardize his career, or at least what he's doing this year with health, would be Hinchcliffe. He would not do that. If he's not ready to get back in the car, he's not gonna risk it. I mean, he would address that intelligently. And if he needed to stay out of the car because he got conked in the head, he's going to do that as much as he would love to continue going. If he says he's okay, then he's okay. Remember, the IndyCar medical guys are some of the best in the world. And if they tell you, stay out of the car, you believe them and you do what they tell you. So, that's a good point, because you think about that and what are the reasons why. It's basically because of, and I hate to use the word luck, but I mean things like the yellow's not coming your way. You get, somebody spins in front of you. Something mechanical happens to the car. These are things you can't control, and I don't know whether there's any residual effect from that concussion. I would not think so in Hinch's case.
Eric, good stuff. Thanks for this.
Always enjoy it, guys. Let's do it again soon.
All right, that is Eric Thomas, the host of Raceline Radio here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, the Honda Indy hitting the streets of Toronto this weekend is delayed on Saturday. They ran a double dip yesterday. Sebastian Bourdais and Mike Conway come out on top. It is 7:30, Brady and Walker. I'm Andrew Walker. He is Eric Smith, filling in for Greg this week. Now, today is the day, D-Day, if you will, Eric, when it comes to Cody Franzen of the Toronto Maple Leafs. He's elected for arbitration, and today is the arbitration day. We get in the ins and outs of all that, but here's the bottom line. The team wants him at the same price, which is $2 million. He didn't have a great year. He wants $4 million or $4.2 million. They can reach a deal at any time before this arbitration hearing. Walking into the boardroom, walking into the office, they could shake hands. Is it fait accompli that this is just going to be, hey, let's meet in the middle here?
I think it should be, because it seems like the easiest answer to the problem that exists right now. And that is, I'm going to bow to your expertise more so than me on Franzen and his abilities and his impact on this team. But I would look at it and say, for a team that still needs pieces, that still needs help, that still needs to shore up the blue line overall, I think you keep a guy like Cody Franzen, or at the very least, get him on a deal that allows you to use him and others in a trade chip later on down the road, at a reasonable rate. I'm not saying you throw the bank at the guy by keeping him, but if you're able to get him at a reasonable price, and I would say three, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it earlier in July that Jeff Petrie, didn't he sign for over $3 million?
$3.5 million on a one-year deal. Thus, avoiding arbitration.
Is he the same or worse than a guy like Cody Franzen? I mean, I would look at it from the outside looking in, not being the hockey guru that many people around here might be, and say Franzen is at least as good, if not better, than a guy like Petrie, who's now making $3.5 million.
It's an interesting comparison, and it's a good comparison. And that will be, I believe, a guy that will get brought to the table in terms of a comparative RFA. Would I trade Cody Franzen for Jeff Petrie straight up? Yeah, I would do that if I'm the Toronto Maple Leafs, but that's just me. It's like, Eric, any sport, whether you cover the NBA or Major League Baseball or the NHL. It's about finding a value, not just so a guy can fit in under your cap, but if he doesn't fit into your plans, is the contract tradable? Now, I think there's a lot of teams out there that would like a guy to play power play and put up some points to make $3 million. I think that's probably where Cody Franzen falls in. I don't think the Leafs want him on their blue line next year. I think they'd love to move him. But in talking to some people yesterday, it's really difficult. And I think they had him traded to the Montreal Canadiens for Josh Georges, and of course that fell through. I think it's really difficult to trade a guy with the looming salary that you don't know what it's going to be. And Cody Franzen needs a deal. If he comes in somewhere around $3 million today, I think it's a tradable deal. And it's not like signing an offer sheet like Shea Weber re-signed with Nashville, then you can't trade him for a year. You can trade him tomorrow if you want after this arbitration hearing. It'll be interesting to see. Not so much what he gets, because I do think they'll meet in the middle. They should meet in the middle probably before this hearing and avoid all the possibility of bad blood that goes on. But how soon is Cody Franzen traded? I think it's quite soon. Also, I teased this earlier. Now, last week on the show, you go through the list of free agents and who's left and who could help the Leafs, and I still think they need a second-line wing.
Well, that's what I wonder as well. If Franzen goes, and I don't mean to take some of your thunder here, but if Franzen goes, who do you plug the hole with then if he either walks or he's dealt?
Well, here's the thing about Franzen is that he's not a top-four guy. He's a 5-6 guy that's good in the power play. And let's say you have a hockey pool. Yeah, you like Cody Franzen because he's going to give you 25 assists per year, 20 of those coming in the power play. And you look at his points and, hey, that's pretty impressive. The last couple of seasons, top 20 in D-men in points. But he's a 5-6 guy. You can replace his 5-6 minutes with, take your pick, Roman Polak, Stefan Robidas, probably playing top four. There's an upgrade defensively. On that power play, all you do is you give Cody Francis minutes to Morgan Riley and Jake Gardner. And I'll tell you what, your power play percentage isn't going down. Your offense isn't going down. Those points are there to be had. Who's going to get them? It's just not Cody Francis, and it's one of those other guys. You still need a second line winger. Can you get that in a Cody Francis trade? I don't know. But I will tell you one guy that's not coming to Toronto, and that was the guy I said should be coming to Toronto last week. It was Devin Setoguchi. Devin Setoguchi, this coming in yesterday, he's down to two teams, both in the Eastern Conference, neither of which are the Toronto Maple Leafs. I thought it would be a guy that could fit here. Turns out, I guess it's not. 735, Brady and Walker. I'm Andrew Walker. He is Eric Smith. Back in on Rory McIlroy. How many majors do we expect at the end of the day from this guy? Ian Leggett, Sportsnet's golf analyst, joins us at 742.
Cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Always the best sports talk on Brady and Walker. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All I know is that I've won my third major championship and I'm, you know, three legs, you know, out of the four towards a career grand slam at 25. So I'm feeling pretty good right now.
743, that is Rory McIlroy, 25 years of age and three major titles in three different golf tournaments. What did you accomplish before the age of 25, Eric? The answer is nothing.
Nothing.
That's
yeah,
what
no,
you
I was
accomplished.
Thinking about it for a second and
nothing.
Vapor lock.
You were drunk in a bar. Or no, you're probably drunk on a golf course.
I'll be doing that later today.
It was, I don't know if Royal Liverpool was too easy or if Rory just made a mockery of it, but 17 under with, let's be honest, that's a 17 under and a final round of, I'm just going to hit the middle of the green today. I'm not going to be going for many birdies. That number could have easily been at 20 under, which is a little ridiculous for a tournament like the British Open. We'll ask our next guest about it. Ian Leggett is the co-host of the golf show on Sportsnet, and you can see him on TV as well, the Sportsnet golf analyst. We love his work around major time. And I guess your impressions yesterday, Ian, of Rory's final round. He went in with a 6-stroke lead. He leaves with a 2-stroke win, but it really didn't feel like it was in doubt.
No, it didn't. I think he kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, what have you done since you're 25 years old? And the one thing about Rory, if you look at it, is how he actually won that golf tournament. I mean, he comes in playing off the Scottish Open, and he shoot, you know, can't get over the hurdle of second round scoring. And a couple times, both on Saturday, he lost the lead, and Sunday, you know, getting Sergio two shots off the lead, he never once kind of, you know, faltered. And I think when you look at rolling the clock back to 2011 and him shooting 80, the final round, you know, as a 21-year-old, what that would have done to any other 21-year-old, and the last, you know, 18, 19 months, what he's been through with the scrutiny of changing equipment, you know, the breakup with his fiance, all those kind of things, you know, pile that on top of each other for him to go out and perform the way he did this weekend is pretty remarkable.
And to that point, we were chatting about this a little bit earlier, the mental strength and the mental, you know, force that he showed, I suppose, in not only winning this tournament, but to get himself back on track. Because you just went through everything that he's been through, from equipment to personal life to everything else, to be at this point, to hold off a charge by Sergio like he maybe didn't do, as you mentioned, in 2011. What about the mental strength that it takes, let alone the physical component that allowed him to win this tournament?
Well, I think what it is, you know, he's been searching for one of the swing keys, whatever it might have been. It's all, quite often with tour players, it's a feeling. And I think he's been searching for that something that he hasn't been able to tap into. Like he had mentioned, he says, you know, I wish I could figure out what this is all the time. And when any tour player is struggling, all they have to do is make one golf swing, and there is a sort of a mental trigger that goes on that puts them in a calmer place because they're so confident with their golf swing. So, and then when you tack it on to a guy like Rory McIlroy, who arguably is the most talented player on the PGA Tour right now, his ability to, you know, to compress a golf ball, his short game, you know, the way he manages himself on the golf course, I think you put those all together, that's sort of where the place that Rory McIlroy got on the weekend.
I'm Andrew Walker. He is Eric Smith. We're joined by Sportsnet's Ian Leggett. And I think you're right. You look at the number one golfer in the world right now, rankings-wise, and that is Adam Scott. Maybe it changes here with this. But when Adam Scott is at his best, when Rory McIlroy is at his best, when, I don't know, Henrik Stenson's at his best, there's really no comparison, is there?
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think he can put Adam Scott in that category. I think when Rory McIlroy is at his best, it's pretty impressive. I mean, his, you know, like I said, his distance off the tee is unbelievable, but Adam Scott has that ability. I think those two are very, very closely aligned, and that's, you know, people are talking about the TV ratings and Tiger being away and how there's been sort of a lull in the game of golf as far as viewership goes. But I think it's one of the most exciting times. I mean, you just think of the players right now that are aligned to be world number one. And it's going to change a lot over the next 10 years. It could change week to week. With Rory McIlroy, Adam Scott, Justin Rose, Martin Keimer, you can put Ricky Fowler in there. I mean, it's a pretty exciting time as this sort of new era transcends into what we have as the quality of players, exciting players, too. It's not like you've got, you know, five Jason Duffners lined up, you know, vying for world number one. You've got really exciting players that are going to be beating each other up for the next 10 to 15 years.
So obviously the golf world has a love and hate type of feel with Sergio Garcia. I get it. I've always had a bit of a soft spot for him, but I know he's acted like a dink at times. Yeah. But I've never thought that Sergio was going to retire without having a major championship. I still feel that way. Do you feel he's getting closer? He seems to be really in the mix these days.
He is. I mean, week in and week out. I think he's in a different place mentally. If you look at, you know, 2000 and I think it was 2009 or 2007 was when he finished runner-up to Padraig Harrington. And, you know, he should have won that tournament. He was destroyed by that. He acted immaturely afterwards. And, you know, we've seen it after the Masters, after he's missed cuts. And you're right. But you saw a different Sergio Garcia on Sunday. You know, even though, you know, he left it in the bunker and, you know, normally we'd see, you know, a little temper tantrum come out of that and his head down, but he grinded it out to the bitter end. And I think we've seen a new, we're seeing a new Sergio, a guy who looks like he's having fun, but still is, you know, on the edge all the time. And that's exciting for the game of golf. I mean, if you're looking for someone to, you know, sort of fill the shoes of it, Tiger Woods and the way they play the game, you've got a couple guys that play the game like that in, you know, Ricky Fowler and Sergio Garcia.
Ian, it seems we can't have a conversation without mentioning Tiger Woods. And you were talking about some of those young players that are on the tour now. It seems like when you watch, you get these young guys now that are playing that, as much as they respect what Tiger has done and who he is or who he still could be again one day, they're not necessarily intimidated by him. They kind of have their own I'm not even going to call it cockiness, but their own confidence about their own games, that they're maybe not drawn into the same lure or luster that Tiger once provided and that imposing shadow that he put over the course.
Yeah, and I think a lot of guys knew that. When you went to the tee on Sunday with Tiger Woods, if you were close and you're playing in that last group, you're already starting two over par just because of that intimidation factor, as you said. But, you know, Tiger's got a couple chinks in his armor that, you know, he's gone through between injuries and, you know, the crazy madness that's gone in his life for the last few years, that he's you know, not the same guy. And Tiger knows he's not the same guy. I think mentally he might like to think he is, but from a physical standpoint, I don't think that he actually is. And so, like you said, I think there is an element that other players, when they go to the first tee with Tiger Woods, they know they've got a chance.
Ian Leggett, our guest. I want to ask you quickly about David Hearn, the Brantford, Ontario native. He was the late add, and he played very solidly, makes the cut, and gets a nice payday out of it, Ian.
Yeah, you know, and impressive, too, is, I mean, it's a different movie. I mean, that's a difficult situation to get thrown into, to fly, you know, 6 hours and playing that type of a golf course. As he said, he's never played in a British Open before or ever played that type of a golf course. So, fortunately for him, you know, the conditions stayed down and he didn't see the, you know, the harsh, you know, tragic conditions that we can get at the British Open. And therefore we saw those really low scores, but
it seemed he was relaxed, didn't it? It was just kind of house money.
Yeah, I mean, for him, he's, you know what, David's the kind of guy, when he's got his game on, it doesn't matter where he is. He just kind of plays the game of golf. He doesn't do anything great. He just does everything really nicely. So you put the whole package together, you're going to see a guy at times, you know, play really well, and I think it bodes well for him coming into the Canadian Open this week.
Canadian Open goes at Royal Montreal. Ian Leggett will be there. We'll catch up with you later this week and get all the ins and outs of our national championship. Ian, thanks for this.
Thanks, boys.
All right, that is Ian Leggett, Sportsnet's golf analyst, does terrific work. You can hear him as well, co-hosting on the Golf Show here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan as well. 7:52, I'm Andrew Walker. He is Eric Smith. Now, you're on the road a lot with the Toronto Raptors covering the games. Now, there's not a team in San Diego, but I imagine you have spent quite a bit of time on that West Coast,
yes,
the California road trip, and enjoy being out there. Now, there is this, I saw this yesterday. We see it maybe on the golf course here, an overabundance of, let's say, geese. And I know if you've ever been to the mountains in Banff, there's too many mountain sheep. And they're beautiful to look at. The tourists like them, but they get in the way. They're annoying. Well, this is what's happening at La Jolla Cove in San Diego. Swimmers like to go there. Surfers like to go there. The ocean's right there. Tourists like to check it out. And the sea lion population, you think they're cute, but maybe they're not, has descended upon La Jolla Cove in San Diego, and it's become a problem. There's a lot of excrement, we'll say, foul-smelling creatures.
I would imagine, yeah.
They're becoming aggressive with humans. This is in the newspaper.
Sounds like a fan morning show so far.
The San Diego Reader. And there's so many of them that people have stopped going to this cove. They've completely taken it over. Because if you're, like, going surfing, you're on a wetsuit, they'll start attacking you.
Have you been down to Pier 39 in San Fran?
I have not.
Okay, Pier 39 is where all the sea lions hang out, and they just come up to the dock and they lay over, and it's become the tourist attraction.
Right, because there's probably a few.
Oh, there's 100, if not more, and they do reek. Like, it stinks. It's as awesome as it is to watch them, it is so foul. And there's thousands of people there taking pictures and checking this out, but they're all laying all over the dock, and it is foul. So I can only imagine what it would be in the more natural setting right on the beach and the landmines you'd be dodging.
God, I'm a prairie guy. And I was in Alberta the last 10 years. Have you ever been out to, have you seen them? Have you been to Banff or Jasper?
I have.
Seen the mountains?
I have.
Okay.
Yep.
So, you know, when there's this beautiful, like, sea to sky highway kind of thing. If you go into Whistler, if you go into Banff,
mm-hmm,
and you see animals, you see wildlife, and I'll never understand it. Tourists with dangerous, aggressive wildlife. Like, it'll be a common occurrence. You're driving along the highway, and there'll be a car stopped in the side of the road, and a family of five is outside of their station wagon.
Trying to take a selfie with a bear.
With their camera, inching close to a bear. Mm-hmm. Like a bear that'll rip your face off. And they think it's like a plush toy. I don't think sea lions are that dangerous.
I'd imagine they could be, though.
But
they can do some damage.
I'm not walking up to a sea lion if there's hundreds at this cove. No. I just stop going to the cove. 7:55.
We had a very close encounter with a rattlesnake at a golf course in Arizona.
Oh, me too.
A years
That's
ago.
Another story. Yeah. I almost died.
Yeah.
I want to hear that story. 7:55, Brady and Walker. It's Andrew Walker and Eric Smith. At 8:02, we're back in on the Jays. They had to have that series against the Rangers, and they got it. So where does this leave them, and who were you impressed by over this three-game set with the Rangers?